Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not with us today, but check in next week and she'll be back with us. We have a really cool book today. I so much enjoyed reading this book. In fact, sometimes I don't, you know, I'm trying to read a book a week and sometimes I don't make it the whole way through, but this one I had to get to the end, I gotta say. And our guest is Judith Little, and she's the author of The Chanel Sisters. Judith is an award-winning author of Wickwith Hall. She earned her BA in Foreign Affairs from the University of Virginia and a law degree from the University of Virginia School of Law. She grew up in Virginia and now lives with her husband, three teenagers, and three dogs in Houston, Texas. And you can find her on Instagram or Facebook or her website. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Judith.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, I don't know where to start. Let's see. The Chanel Sisters. It's about Coco Chanel and her sisters. What drew you to this topic?
Well, the Chanel Sisters is told from the point of view of Coco's young sister, Antoinette, and she is someone who has been previously unknown, so I wanted to tell her story because there have been a lot of novels written about and biographies about Coco Chanel, but none told from the point of view of Antoinette. So I was first drawn to the idea when I found out Coco had a sister, because I had no idea that she even did, and then I was just really intrigued by the idea of what it would have been like to have been the younger sister of Coco Chanel.
Was it hard to find out a lot of information about her?
It was, because not a lot is known about Antoinette. There's so much known about Coco. You know, and Coco had a very long and very complicated life. Antoinette was kind of lost in the shadows of Coco's life. She turned out to be, from my research, I discovered that she played a big role in the founding of the Chanel Empire that had never really been discussed before. Most of Coco's biographers have so much on their hands dealing with Coco that they didn't really pay a lot of attention to Antoinette. So there are some things that, you know, are known for sure about Antoinette, some facts and dates and places, but there are also quite a few gaps in what we know about her, kind of in the middle. So I researched as much as I could. I looked at French census records to try to place her as much as I could and wherever she was in France. And then I looked at old French newspapers to see if I could find more information about her there. I looked for any kind of other, you know, government records I could find. I spoke to some distant family members in Canada who had done some genealogical research that they were nice enough to share with me. And so through all that, you know, I came up with everything that I could find that is known about Antoinette. And then I just logically extrapolated from there what I thought was likely in her life.
And at the back of the book, there's a section where you talk about what is historically accurate and what you extrapolated. And I don't want to give anything away, but I got to admit, I was a little disappointed that some of the things that I hoped were true weren't, well, let's not say they may have been true, but they weren't factually based.
Well, I think I probably know what you're talking about without giving it away.
Right, right.
But, you know, there was only so much I could do with a certain part of her life. I mean, I guess I would say one of the characters who is logically extrapolated, but it's not based from what I know of on a real person. But I feel I did write it in a way. I didn't change anything. I didn't move any dates around. I didn't, combine people into two people or anything like that. So I wrote it in a way that it could have happened. So even if there's something that I don't know for sure did happen, I wanted it to be that, you know, we don't know what happened in certain parts of her life, but this actually could have happened.
And it definitely feels true.
That's, yeah, I don't know if that makes you feel any better, but it could have happened. So.
Right, right. So it must have been really exciting when you were doing this research and were able to find her on census records. Is her name so it's hard to imagine. There must be, some names, there'd be dozens of people. How would you actually know for sure if that's the person you're thinking of? Or was her name unusual enough that it was obvious when you found it? And how long did you have to look? And where did you go to look? Is this all available online?
Well, thankfully it was. And it did take forever, although it was fun. So the French census records are all online for the most part. Most of them are, thank goodness. But they're not searchable. They're not, entered by anybody. So they're actual, scanned, I guess, photocopies of the pages from old books, which makes it really interesting, to see how it was really written in the books and the beautiful handwriting that people had back then, which, my kids can barely read cursive now, and the handwriting from that time is confusing too. So I spent a lot of time just going page by page in the various, I was able to narrow it down to various places where I knew she was. For instance, I knew she was in, or I had a great, all signs pointed to her being in Vichy during a certain time. And I did find Antoinette Chanel in Vichy at the time I thought she was, and she was living over a hat shop. So that made sense to me. And the name Antoinette and the name Chanel were not really, there were not a lot of Chanels, believe it or not. That wasn't really an issue, but what was an issue was trying to read the handwriting, just pouring through all those pages. One thing interesting, though, is that Coco, her name, her real name was Gabrielle, but she's in one of the census records before she was famous and she was a mistress of a wealthy man, and you can find the census records for her living at his chateau, and there she is right there.
Wow.
I know, yeah. Gabrielle Chanel, right under his name, but I guess then people couldn't look it up like we can now.
Wow. Yeah. So, if my mother were with us on this interview today, she would be bemoaning the fact that kids can't read cursive handwriting anymore, because how are researchers 50 years from now going to be able to read any of this stuff?
I know. It's funny. I didn't realize they couldn't read cursive until my daughter came home from camp one year, and she told me that she got a lot of letters from my mother, her grandmother, and she's like, yeah, but I couldn't read any of them. And I was like, oh. Yeah. It's odd. It's kind of a dying art.
Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't even be able to read the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution or all these things that were handwritten in the past. So what time, when were the Chanel sisters born? So what time period does your book cover?
So the book starts in 1897 when Coco was about 12 and Antoinette would have been 8. And it ends in 1921. So it does not cover the entire span of Coco's life. It ends right when she becomes finally famous and wealthy. At the end of World War One. So I didn't want to, I think it would have been like War and Peace if I had gone on all the way to the 1970s when she died. But I really just wanted to tell the story of her and Antoinette. So it starts when they are young and they are living in a convent orphanage. Their mother had died and their father abandoned them there. They were from a very poor family that, was really a family of vagabond salesmen. They went from town to town selling used goods. Their mother died in her 30s of just kind of ill health and exhaustion. And then their lives completely changed by being taken in by the nuns. And so they kind of went from a chaotic existence to a life where, you know, every single minute of every single day was relegated to something or had some kind of purpose. So it starts out there in the convent orphanage and then follows them as they go out into the world and try to make something of themselves.
Do you think one of the reasons that Antoinette is not really well known or not much attention has been paid to her is that by the time Coco became truly famous, Antoinette wasn't around?
Yeah, I do think that. I think that is one reason. I also think that Coco, you know, she had had a lot of tragedy in her past even by then, and so she didn't like to talk about the past. I think she was the kind of person who looked forward, and rather than dwelling on, you know, the fact that her mother had died and her father abandoned her, which was something she never told anybody. She kept that secret to her grave. She never told anybody that she was raised in a convent orphanage. That was something that biographers dug up on her. She just kept, you know, as much of her past a secret as she could. And I think, like all, you know, a lot of the fashion designers, you know, they're always thinking one season ahead of everybody else. And that seemed to be her mindset. So I think that's, you know, both of those are big reasons why we haven't heard of Antoinette.
Right. Now, there was another sister, too, that you write about. Were you able to find much about her?
Julia Barrett was their older sister, and she was she's kind of a mystery, too. And so I did find something interesting about her. She died young, and Coco, in Coco's biographies, they pretty much say that Coco said that she committed suicide by rolling naked in the snow, which is kind of odd. But... but that is what Coco told people. And so as I was writing, you know, I was thinking, well, I don't have anything else to go on, so I'm going to have to go with this. But I was doing research at the same time, and I ended up finding a death certificate for Julia Barrett. And she actually died in Paris in May when there wouldn't have been, any snow. And there was no record of her ever coming to Paris. And it was also a hospital for, people with money, which was also interesting. And unfortunately, the death certificate did not reveal how she died. But so that's something that I hadn't seen that anywhere in any of the biographies of Coco. But so I worked with that and kind of used a hybrid story of where she had, gotten ill by being out in the cold, and then that had affected her health. And so she came to Paris, and ultimately that was where she died.
Now, in the novel, in the Chanel sisters, that this older sister seems a little simple-minded. Was there anything that, you know, historically that you could pinpoint that on, other than, I guess, rolling naked in the snow? But
no, that's what the biographies say, that Julia Barrett was, a lot of them say she was a little slow. So I'm kind of odd when it comes to being a fiction writer, and that I don't like to make things up. So I like, you know, to use the, I like to write historical fiction because I just find history so fascinating. So I like to, you know, write as much as I can that really happened. And so for Julia Barrett, they did, nobody said why she was slow or anything more about that, but just that she was a little bit slow.
Now, these three sisters had a couple of brothers, too, that you mentioned early on in the book, but we don't hear anything about them later. Did Coco ever try and find them, or did you try and find out anything about them?
They did come into Coco's life later. They, basically, once she became rich and famous, she paid them off to not talk about her or her past or where she came from. So she supported them for a long time. I think eventually she did cut them off, but she basically paid them to not, you know, spill beans on the convent orphanage thing. And then, but there was no real no other real connection between her and them.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Judith Little, author of The Chanel Sisters. Now, there's some kind of anniversaries about the Chanels going on or around this time, I think. I believe I saw something about it being the 50th anniversary of Coco's death. And also something about an anniversary of Chanel No. 5. Were you, you know, sort of aware of these anniversaries when you were writing this book?
You know, I wasn't. I was not aware. Maybe that's Coco's, maybe she's giving her blessings that the timing worked out from above. I don't know. She didn't like anybody writing about her at all, though. And it was just kind of funny because she had a best friend that a lot of people don't know about. And the best friend went to write her memoir, and she had written a whole chapter on Coco. I mean, they spent 30 years together doing everything together. And Coco insisted that she remove any reference to Coco from her book because Coco said, I'm going to write my own biography. And so you can read her friend's memoirs and not a word is said about Coco.
Now, was this the friend that that her aunt Adrienne didn't like?
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly. And then there's another biographer, Edmond Charles Roux, who wrote a really fascinating, what I think really the best biography of Coco Chanel. She and Coco were friends, and which is why it's such a great biography, because she was able to interview people, you know, who knew Coco and who knew Antoinette too. And but Coco, you know, cut her off as soon as she said she was writing this biography, and they never spoke again after that.
Wow, that's, I guess she was a very private person.
She was very private. Yeah. She liked to control the narrative, you know, as much as she could.
It was pretty amazing what these two women accomplished. And I think it's, you know, in your book, you portray Antoinette as more of the business side of things. And of course, Coco must have eventually come or either found someone else to take Antoinette's place on that side, or maybe she developed those skills herself. But do you feel like it was pretty accurate to say that Chanel, that Coco couldn't have done what she did without Antoinette's support?
I think so. I mean, I'm partial, of course, but I mean, when Coco, you know, Coco did not intend to be a fashion designer, or, you know, she started out selling hats, but that was not what she wanted to do with her life. And so she came upon that accidentally because everything else she had tried had failed, and she made hats for herself just because she didn't like what was out there. And other women started asking her where she got her hats and then asking her to make them for them. And that's how Chanel started. So she didn't go into it with any kind of business sense or any idea that, you know, this was what she wanted to do or how to do it. Antoinette, you know, based on my research where I found her in Vichy living over a hat shop, she could have had this experience, you know, selling hats. And from the biographies and the way that the stores worked in the beginning, it was Antoinette who was out front. Coco didn't like to sell, and so she would stay in the back, and Antoinette was really the face that would greet customers and deal with them face-to-face. And there's one anecdote about Coco that's also in the novel where, you know, she has a lover, and he basically finances the first Chanel boutique for her because she doesn't have any money. And she has, the boutique has been open for about a year, and she thinks she's made all this money, and they're walking to dinner one night, and she says to him, you know, I can't believe how easy it is to make money. Like, who would have thought? You know, if I had known all along how easy it was. And he laughed at her and said, what do you mean? And she said, well, every time I ask the bank for money, they give me money. And then he said, well, that's because I've written a line of credit. So that's my money. And she had no idea. She was so upset. She threw her purse at him and ran back to their apartment. And then from that day forward, that was really when she became a businesswoman, and she vowed to track every centime that went in and out of the store along with Antoinette. And so I do think, I mean, Antoinette was there You know, if you're opening a business, you have to have people you rely on, especially if you don't know what you're doing. And so during the time that Antoinette was with her, you know, they opened up 3 boutiques. And also during that time is when Coco became independent of Boy Capel, who had financed her. You know, she paid him back everything. And during that time is when, you know, Chanel took off and Chanel became famous and Coco got wealthy. So I do think Antoinette must have played a big role.
Now, you mentioned that you researched old French newspapers to find some records of Antoinette. What did you find?
Well, that's a really good question because I didn't find, at first I found nothing. And I was really surprised that I couldn't find anything about Coco or Antoinette in the newspapers. And I realized that the mistake I was making was I was looking at it using modern thinking. I thought, of course, they would be in the society pages. And, of course, they were not in the society pages because they weren't society. At that time, they were just tradeswomen. And those kinds of people, I mean, later, of course, Coco would be in those pages. But at that time, you know, they basically didn't really even exist in what the French called Le Monde, which was the world. You know, there was Le Monde and the Demi Monde, and they were more in the Demi Monde, which was how they divided society up back then. But I did find in the papers something really interesting that's also incorporated in the book, where Antoinette's name kept popping up in this one section that records people's comings and goings. So it's like a notice in the newspaper where you can publish a notice of where you're going to be. And so her name would pop up in there with other people, and saying, you know, that Antoinette Chanel would be in Paris, or that she would be in Monte Carlo, or she would be in Deville. And I didn't recognize the names of anybody else that was there at the same time. And so for a long time, I couldn't figure out, like, why is her name? What is this? And then I finally realized that she was telling Chanel clients where she was going to be, because this was at the time when they had the 3 boutiques in the 3 cities. And the clients, you know, depended on her. And she must have been important if she had to put her name in the paper and letting, you know, people know where she was going to be. So that small little thing really told me a lot.
So how did it feel when you found that? Was it like you found the key to the treasure?
Kind of, yeah. It was like, it was exciting and then mysterious and frustrating all at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Now, this area in this time period in Paris is maybe not one that's written about a lot or that we read about a lot, because it's before and during and just immediately after World War I. And we tend to read more about the period between the wars or during World War II in historical fiction. But this is a really fascinating time period. Can you paint us a picture of what Paris was like during this time period?
Sure. Well, you know, I could, if you want, I could read a little section about...
That sounds perfect.
Should I do that? Okay.
Yes.
Because I do have one section. Paris was crazy right before World War I. I mean, it was just, everybody was having a great time, let me put it that way. Very fun. And one thing that was very popular at the time was the tango. Everybody was doing the tango. And so there's a scene in the book where they are at the boutique on the Rue Cambon, and it's Antoinette and Coco and their aunt Adrienne, who was also a big part of their lives. And Antoinette has a love interest. His name is Lucho, but he is not there at the time. But he has sent one of his relatives to Paris. And so that, I'm trying to think if there's anything else to set this up. And she was known as Antoinetta to Lucho. So, okay. Back in Paris, the tango showed no signs of fading out. Parisians flocked to the Tangote, events hosted by hotels for 4 francs a person with sandwiches and tea for refreshment. Later, there were tango parties, charity tangos, tango balls, tango dinners. Xavier Herouz published an article debating the proper style of tango. Ladies of the Monde hired professional instructors. There were tango shoes, tango trouserettes, special loose tango corsets. Skirts had to be raised to keep from tripping. Cobble skirts, at last, were done for. Even hats were different, with one aigrette straight up at attention in the front rather than a plume meandering off to the side, which could leave a dancer unbalanced. Everything was tango, tango, tango. The color orange was no longer the color orange. It was the couleur tango. Antonietta, I heard someone call out one afternoon at the Rue Cambon boutique in a voice that couldn't be Lucho's. It was September, which meant he was already back in Argentina. I looked up from the orders Gabrielle and I were going through to see a young man with a dazzling smile standing in the doorway. His thick black hair was combed back with brilliantine. He wore white spats, flamboyant clothing, a fresh carnation in his lapel, and carried a large, unusual case. "Who is that?" Gabrielle, sitting next to me, whispered under her breath as Adrian, trying on hats in front of the mirror, exclaimed, "What in the world?" "Arturo." I stood to greet him. "You must be Lucho's cousin from Buenos Aires." Arturo bowed formally. "Arturo de Alba de Velado de Arujo de Harrington," he said, as if he were at the court of Versailles. I hid a smile. I hadn't met Arturo before, but Lucho had said he was a character, a bon vivant, the family black sheep because he preferred the nightclubs to the estancia. He was a charmer, a dandy. He was 5 years younger than Lucho, and his parents had cut him off until he became more serious. He had a glittering smile, intense eyes, a joie de vivre mixed with a Latin swagger that was irresistible. "He's here to give tango lessons," I explained to Gabrielle and Adrian. Young men from Argentina had been flocking to Paris as instructors to take advantage of the craze. "Here?" said Gabrielle with a confused look, motioning to the boutique. "Not here in the boutique," I said. "Paris." Adrian smiled. "Well, since he's here in the boutique, Señor de Harrington, show us what you can do, s'il vous plaît. We all love the tango." "That," he said, eyes flashing, "would be my pleasure. But first," he opened his case and, to our astonishment, pulled out a portable gramophone. He put on a recording and swept me around the boutique, tango walking very intensely this direction and then that with sudden dips and turns. Adrian had a turn and then Gabrielle, after which we noticed a trio of ladies had gathered inside near the door, our next appointment, staring. "Mesdames," Arturo said, turning to them with a flourish. I hurried to greet them, but they didn't want to speak to me. They wanted Arturo. "Do you give lessons, monsieur?" one asked. He drew out a card and handed it to her, entrancing her with his grin, his exuberance contagious. "At your service, madame," he said, and then held out a hand. "Shall we?" Who could refuse? Everyone wanted a turn. That afternoon, we didn't sell a single hat. All anyone cared about was Arturo. Customers asked when he'd come back. "You have to come every afternoon," I told him. "You can hand out your card to our customers. They'll want to take lessons from you, and soon enough you'll be teaching all of Paris to tango." He did return with his gramophone, sometimes taking even Angèle around in a lusty tango that made her blush. His client list grew, and so did ours. All the ladies wanted to be around Arturo, but I had my own reason. He reminded me that Lucho, so far away, was real. I wanted to ask Arturo about Lucho's wife. Did he know her? What was she like? But I didn't let myself. Once I started thinking about her, I'd never stop. Before long, Arturo became the most sought-after instructor in the city. A group of society ladies, led by the Princess Marat, rented a lavish mansion on the Champs-Élysées and set him up there for lessons, issuing tickets in order of priority. Blue tickets for ladies of the Gratin, pink ladies for ladies of the next tier of the Monde. It was 1913, and the world was practically unrecognizable. There were motor cars on the streets, more motor cars on the streets than horses. Brave men attempted to conquer the sky in flying machines or drove at death-defying speeds in cross-country motor races. The globe seemed to be expanding and shrinking at the same time, and all everyone wanted to do was dance, to cling to each other and move about in preordained patterns on the floor, this direction, then that direction, then this direction again. It was the only way to know exactly where you would end up.
And that was Judith Little reading from her historical novel, The Chanel Sisters. And just for make sure people understand, Gabriella was actually Coco's real name. So how did she get the name Coco?
Well, she told people that Coco was a term of endearment that her father used, which we, the biographers, do not think is correct, because she did make up stories about her father to make it look like he had not abandoned her. The theory is she got the name because after she got out of the convent orphanage and was living on her own, she wanted to be a singer and a performer. Back in those days, for women who were born into poverty, like Coco and Antoinette, it was very difficult to rise out of that. And there were two ways that you could become wealthy. And one was to be the mistress of a wealthy man and sort of take the jewels that he would give you and save them as your 401k plan if you were smart. And another was by a career on the stage. And so Coco wanted this career on the stage. And so she started singing in a little cafe in Mulan. There was a garrison there, so there were soldiers. And her signature song was called Coco at the Trocadero, about a little lost dog. And so she would perform that, and she became pretty well known there. And the soldiers would pound on the tables and yell, Coco, Coco, Coco. And that was how she got the name.
And how did the biographers find that information? Because I'm guessing she really wanted to keep that hidden.
She did, yes. That was another part of her life that she kept hidden. Although for the rest of her life, she still had that dream of being a singer. She took singing lessons until she was, you know, even in her 80s. She just could not let go of the dream of being on the stage. But evidently she didn't have the talent for that. So I don't, you know, the biographers, like I said, it was the one who was a contemporary of Coco, I think a little bit younger, but so she dug around and she, like, for instance, the story about Arturo that I read, I thought that that had to be made up because I read about that in one of the biographies. And I thought that's just so odd because this man shows up later in the book, just kind of out of the blue. But then I found out that this biographer had actually interviewed the family, one of the family members who was at the home when Arturo did show up, this guy carrying around the gramophone wherever he went. And so I was like, well, I've got to write him in the story. He just sounds so fascinating. So I think these, you know, she's a lot of the earlier biographers really, they didn't, if you didn't take Coco at her word, what she said about her life, because even in, she tried to dictate her own memoirs to a friend, and in those she even lied about her past. So if you didn't take what she said about her past at face value, then I think you could find out what really happened.
Wow. So who were the three Graces, and how, you know, how did you find out about that?
The three Graces were Coco, Antoinette, and then their aunt, Adrienne, who she was their aunt, but she was really just a year older than Coco. And she was very, very graceful, beautiful woman, but also just as poor as Coco and Antoinette. And, but she had a certain kind of inner confidence that I think was unusual at the time. And, was not afraid of going out in the world and asking for what she wanted. And so in Mulan, when the girls had just started out on their own after living with the nuns, they would go out in the town together, and with all these soldiers there, they would be seen by the soldiers. And then eventually Coco and Adrienne worked as seamstresses in a little shop, and they also got some work repairing the soldiers' uniforms, and soon they got invited to the little cafes or for ice cream with these soldiers, and it was the soldiers who gave them the nickname the Three Graces.
And which one was Antoinette?
Oh gosh, which one? I think was youth, right? I think she was youth.
Yep. She was youth because she was the youngest. So the Three Graces are what? Beauty,
mirth, and youth, I think.
Mirth and youth. Yeah, I don't know if out of those three, if I'd want to be mirth. But
yeah, I know.
In the long run, I would, but maybe not when I'm in my 20s and flirting with soldiers. Now, World War I had a big impact on the Chanel sisters, and in some ways, they benefited greatly from it. How did that happen?
That's really interesting. It had a huge impact on them. And it was the time when Coco became rich because her fashion sense was very unique for the time and came, I think, from two places. One was she had a great desire for freedom. I think having grown up in poverty, and then at a convent orphanage, and as a female at the time, I think she felt very, very restricted. And by the time she got out of that convent, she just wanted to live life. And women's clothing at the time didn't allow women to do that to the same extent. Of course, that men could. Women were still wearing corsets. And if you look at the fashions of the time, they were wearing just these gigantic hats, really huge hats, and layers of clothing. And I'd spoken about the hobble skirts, but that was a real thing. You know, they hobbled women. And Coco couldn't stand any of that. And so she made her own hats. She made her own clothes. She also couldn't afford the more expensive, fancier thing. So it might have come from that as well. And then she had lived for a time with her lover, Etienne Balsan, and she wore his clothes all the time because she didn't have a lot of clothes and they were in a country house and she learned to horseback ride there and she would horseback ride in men's clothing. So I think she got used to how much more comfortable and practical men's clothing was. So she devised her own comfortable outfits that were easy to move around in. And then World War One came around and that was the kind of clothing that women needed because women were more active when the men went off to war. They were taking some of the jobs that men had had. And then they also were volunteering, for instance, in DeVille, where Coco had had her second boutique. A lot of the society women there had volunteered at a hospital. And the doctors told them, you know, they could not wear the clothes that they were wearing, that they were dangerous and impractical. And they pulled some old nurses' uniforms out of a cabinet and told these society ladies that they had to wear those. And, of course, they were appalled. And so they took them to Coco, and she fixed them up. I mean, she was still, you know, still had, you know, simple lines and the elegance that she's known for. But she took these uniforms and made them so they fit. And that was really one of the first things she did. But so during the war, everything she made was the style of the time that made sense and was practical for people. And then she was also willing to use fabrics that other people, other designers wouldn't use. So she used,
oh, I found that really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about jersey.
She found jersey, which was a fabric that was used for men's underthings at the time. But someone had a lot of it and fabric was hard to come by then because of the war. And so she bought up all of this jersey and made women's suits out of it, you know, the dresses and the jackets, which became a huge hit. And so she had all these society ladies spending a lot of money for clothing made out of what used to be the fabric of men's underwear. She was very adaptable that way, and not really very much of a snob when it came to that. She would also use furs during World War One. It was very cold and they didn't have enough coal. And so people were freezing and she used rabbit fur, which was something that, you know, only up until then that peasants would wear, but she had the society ladies wearing rabbit fur. She came up with pajamas that people wore in the bomb shelters. She was just a very adaptable person.
When did the, you know, when I think of Coco Chanel, there's two things I think of. One is Chanel No. 5, and the other is the little Chanel suit. Now, did her foray into perfume start during this time period also?
No, that started right after the book ends, or it kind of began a little bit, but didn't really take off until the book ends. So that started in 1921 is when she released Chanel No. 5, which... So it was May of 1921. So there is, this May will be the, what is that, the 100th anniversary?
100th, yeah.
Yeah. So that's a pretty big deal. I mean, and it's, can you believe it's still here and people still wear it? It's kind of crazy.
It is. Yeah, there aren't too many things that were, you know, introduced in 1921 that are still so loved.
No, there aren't. But that And that is what actually made her rich, is the perfume.
And what about the little Chanel suit? I'm thinking like boucle and you know, kind of the little pebbled fabrics.
She started using tweeds. This is a little bit later too. She used those nut fabrics that she wasn't, again, you know, wasn't something that most of the high-end designers would use, and that you could say derived from her time at the convent when she wore the uniform of a charity case orphan that was this rough wool. And she carried that into her own designs later. The Chanel, famous Chanel suit, could also have come from those days at the convent when you wore a uniform. And her suit is kind of like a uniform. I think her philosophy was that a woman should dress to live, not live to dress. And so she had all these suits, and you wake up in the morning and that's what you wear, and you don't have to think about it anymore, and you go about your day. The black dress that she was also famous for, that came a little bit after the book as well. She was one of the first to use black in a everyday way instead of, you know, as we all know, it used to be just for mourning. But she translated that into, you know, simple fashion for women, because she thought, you know, a woman shouldn't be overshadowed by what she wore. You should be able to see the woman. She has some quote, which I'm sure I'm going to get it wrong, but maybe you know, when a woman wears a bad dress, you remember the dress, but when she dresses nicely, you remember the woman.
Ah, yes, yeah. Wow.
I definitely didn't say that right, but that's
but the meaning's clear. The meaning's clear. Now, you mentioned that she, you know, did have a couple of wealthy lovers, and Adrian, her aunt, did also, and you think Antoinette did as well. Was this a, you know, was it hard to, what do you say this? You know, you talk about society being split into the monde and the demi-monde, and of course the mistresses weren't in the monde, but a lot of their clientele was. How did that work? You know, wasn't it a little hard to be selling to these women who probably were really resented the mistresses, or did they not resent the mistresses?
Well, they definitely had to make sure that their appointments were scheduled so that the mistresses and the wives did not show up at the same time. That was an issue. That was an issue at the time. But the, you know, mistresses were so accepted in French society at the time. It was is so common. A lot of the marriages in high society were not love-based marriages. They were more like mergers and acquisitions of titles and properties and money. So it was different than I think it's harder for us to relate to that. But it wasn't unusual. It was odd in that the patrons of Chanel before the 1920s, when society really changed, you know, they would spend all this time telling Coco or Antoinette their secrets while they were at the boutique trying on clothes and figuring out their wardrobe. And then they would see them, you know, at the horse races, but would not even acknowledge them. They weren't even able to sit in the area at the hippodrome where society sat. They were out on the grassy part.
Now, are you familiar with the Book of the Courtesans in Paris? Apparently, I've been following this writer, Summer Brennan, who's writing a book about this. In the archives of the Paris police, there was this book that was really big, had a, you know, leather binding, it was locked, and it contained the criminal files of a group of women they called the undominated, which were basically the mistresses of wealthy people. Some were actresses, some were dancers, so forth. But this was earlier. I think this was during the 1800s. So the vice squad surveilled all of them. Do you know if there was anything still going on like that during, by the time that the Chanel sisters were in that situation?
Gosh, I don't know. That's a good question. I wouldn't be surprised if there was. I mean, supposedly, you know, she was surveilled during, I think, during World War One and during World War Two. But, and I know that, I think there was the maitre d' of Maxime's, the restaurant, you know, he had his own little book of the courtesans and, you know, rating them and that kind of thing. So it was a really interesting facet of society. There was, I'd also read about a famous courtesan who had died, and they were doing an estate sale of her apartment. And so all the ladies of society went to the estate sale so they could get inside her apartment and see what was in there.
Maybe try and get some of their missing jewelry back.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. So I want to ask you a little bit about your earlier book, too, because this is your second historical novel. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And the first one was Wickwith Hall. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Wickwith Hall is set in an English country home. It's a World War II novel that takes place in a time period, kind of a briefer time period before the U.S. was in the war. It's told from the point of view of an American expat who's married to a wealthy Brit. They're the owners of the country house. And then there's an American who is a secret liaison between Churchill and Roosevelt, and then a French refugee who ends up all at this country house. And it's sort of a story about the three of them against the backdrop of a historical event that I had read about, ironically enough, in a biography of Coco Chanel. I hadn't heard of it, but in July of 1940, the British Navy fired on the French fleet to keep the ships from the Germans. It was right after France had surrendered to the Germans. And in the process, they killed over 1,000 French sailors. And so I was so shocked to read about that. I'd never heard of it, that I decided to kind of bring that to life in a novel. Although it's not a military novel, it doesn't, you know, we're not on naval ships except for a very brief period of time. So I wanted to tell sort of the human side, but also tell a little bit about what happened.
Now, in that book, you have Roosevelt and Churchill sort of as characters. I don't know how much, but was it hard to write, to fictionalize someone who's so well known? Whereas with Coco Chanel, maybe it's a little easier because we don't really know what she was like as a young woman. But with these two, was it more difficult?
Actually, it wasn't.
Or easier.
I thought it was easier. Coco kind of intimidates me. I don't know. That's why, I mean, I don't know if I could ever write a book in trying to be in Coco's voice. That might be a little scary. But Churchill, for some reason, he was really fun to write. I mean, talk about a fascinating, quirky person. He just was, you know, he used to dictate letters in the bathtub to his secretary, who would have to sit outside the door, you know, with the door cracked, and then he would go underwater from time to time while he was talking. And, you know, talk about Me Too. I mean, he wasn't harassing anybody, but he would just walk, you know, he had no sense of modesty and would just walk around in his bathroom.
Undressed.
Yeah. For less. So I thought he was really fascinating. I mean, he would, you know, he took a nap every day at the same time. He pretty much drank all day long, a little bit. You know, he never drank a lot during the day, but he always had a little bit going. Just really, really fascinating person. And then Roosevelt, he's not in the book quite as much, but I had fun. You know, like I said, I don't like to make a lot of stuff up. So if I can fictionalize, but really.
Ah, yes. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask you a little bit about how you started writing, because you went to law school. I assume you at some point maybe worked as an attorney. How do you make the shift from that to writing historical fiction?
Well, I actually still work as an attorney, so I do both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Well, and there are a lot of writers who are or were attorneys. I think that's kind of more of our skill set than, say, being an engineer. But there are a lot of parallels between my law job and, you know, which involves a lot of research and a lot of writing. And, but there's no creative outlet. And so I turned to fiction in order to be able to be a little more creative, and also started writing when my kids were little as an escape and a bit of a stress reliever, which still, they're older now, but it's still the same. It's an imaginary world that I can make up and go hide in for a little while if I need to, and where I can make the characters do what I tell them to do.
Unlike teenagers,
they're not sassy. They don't talk back. Sometimes they do, but not usually. So I really started writing when my kids were little, and I just needed some kind of outlet. And it still is a big, you know, if I'm having just kind of a stressful day, then a lot of times I think, oh, I just need to spend some time writing so I can pretend that this world and its problems don't exist for a little while.
Now, when you started writing and at some point you decided to try and get published, what was your path to publication?
Very, very long, filled with rejection. For the first novel, Wickwith Hall, you know, to be published by a traditional publisher, you have to have an agent. So the agent process took forever. But also in all of the rejection, that was how I learned to tell a story. Because when I started out, I had always been a good enough writer. But what I didn't realize was that I didn't know how to tell a story. And so I, once I thought the novel was done and I would send it out to agents, it would get rejected, but then there was always an agent or two or sometimes three who would give me some feedback. So I would take that feedback and rewrite, and then I would send it out again, and the same thing would happen. But, you know, some nice agent would give me feedback. And so that process went on for probably about 6 years as it got closer and closer. And then eventually I got an agent, and then she sold it. Of course, the first book took a longer to sell than the second book, but yeah, it was definitely not a get rich quick scheme or get scheme
or get successful quick. So you stuck with that same book and reworked it, rather than, because some writers that we've talked to, they just put that one in a drawer when they realize what it was they didn't know about telling a story, and start with something new. What made you decide to stick with that one?
Well, I did have one of those novels too. It was terrible. And I,
oh, okay.
Yeah, I have that one. I mean, it's just bad. Like I would never show it to anybody. But Wickwith Hall, I just really wanted to tell that story. It was really for the historical aspect of it. I felt like, I mean, and if I kept getting that feedback, like I was just always so close. Like I was never over the finish line with, you know, getting that agent, but I was always so close that I couldn't give up because there was always something else to do. Although at one point it did seem like it was the end and I didn't know what I was going to do, because I thought, well, what do I do now? Like all I do is write, so I don't know what to do with myself. And then I think that's when I got the offer from the publisher to publish it. But
Oh. It
was just always, you know, close, but there's always a little bit of hope.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Judith Little, and I forgot to reintroduce you midway because I got so fascinated by our conversation. Judith is the author of The Chanel Sisters, and also Wickwith Hall, which was her earlier book that we talked about. Have you always been fascinated by history?
I have. Well, I was a foreign affairs major in college, which is really a lot of history, and then kind of the relations between countries, which I've always found to be really interesting. And then I have always loved historical fiction, and I've also always loved reading biographies. I find them just, you know, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
That's for sure. Yeah, because a lot of times things that happen, if you wrote them in a fictional way, they aren't believable.
Yeah, they're not.
Yeah. So what are you working on next?
I am working on my third novel that is also historical, and it takes place in Paris in the 1920s and 1930s. It's going to involve Coco Chanel again, but again, she's not going to be the narrator.
That sounds like a great time to write about. That's such a fascinating era. And of course, I'm guessing if you're in the 20s and 30s in Paris, you may be introducing some expat Americans into the story.
I think so. You know, it's still, I haven't gotten very far with it, unfortunately. So there's still, you know, who knows what's around the next corner. But yeah, I mean, it was a really fascinating time. And that's kind of what's fun about writing is, you know, I learned so much about World War II in the first book, and then I learned so much about the early 1900s and World War I in the second. So now it's been a lot of fun to learn a lot about Paris in the 20s and 30s.
I love the movie Midnight in Paris.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I just love that. Have you spent much time in Paris?
When I was in college, I did a study abroad, so I lived there for a little while, and right by the Eiffel Tower, which was great. So I did have that experience, and I went to the Institut Catholique, which is a school there, college, where I took a class at the same time. And then I've been back just to visit, you know, with family and friends and that kind of thing.
Well, don't you think you really need to go to research this next book?
I do. I'm dying to go back. And in fact, the convent orphanage where Coco and Antoinette grew up is, you know, it's still there. It's in the middle of France, kind of in the mountains. I've heard it's hard to get to, but it's there and it's gorgeous. They even have an Instagram page, which is fun to follow because they have so many beautiful pictures of it. And they have a little cat that we follow around on their Instagram page called Sha Chanel.
Oh,
but it just looks.
And can you actually stay there? Do they have lodging?
They do in the town. I think the reason this is on Instagram is because it's for tourism. I don't think you can stay at the actual convent. It's not an orphanage anymore, and I don't think it's used for religious purposes, although I'm not positive. But they are doing this to try to get more tourists to the area, so there should be places to stay.
Yeah. So, Judith, have your children read either of your books?
They have not. No, that is, you're hitting a sore spot right there. No, they have not read my book.
Do you want them to?
I do. Yes, I've asked. Yeah. I mean, my son is even a history major, and he has not read my first book, which kind of surprises me. But their friends, some of their friends have read them. I hear.
Oh, wow. Yeah, they should definitely read them.
I think there must be.
You can tell them I said so.
I will. There must be something about it's no fun to read your mom's book. I don't know. It must feel like a chore if it's your mom's book, you know?
Yeah, that's probably true. But I think if they started, they'd change their minds about that in a hurry.
Well, they won't even let me read their papers or anything. They won't help me say that. It's funny.
Well, Judith, we're out of time, and I just really want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. It was great. It was so fun.
And we always close with a quote, and I have a perfect quote for this today. It's from Caroline Miss, M-Y-S-S. I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but she said, "Grace is a power that comes in and transforms a moment into something better."
Oh, that's perfect.
It is.
I love it.
Well, thank you. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.